The kidnapping of Patricia Hearst is very much a story of America in the 1970s, not the 1960s. From the vantage point of nearly half a century, the two decades sometimes merge in historical memory as a seamless epoch of idealism and change. Generalizations about eras are necessarily imperfect, of course, but these two decades actually look very different in retrospect. The 1960s were hopeful. The 1970s, sour. The 1960s were about success. The 1970s, about failure. The 1960s were sporadically violent. The 1970s, pervasively violent. There were assassinations and riots in the 1960s, but the vast majority of protests were peaceful and even, occasionally, successful. After an extraordinary public outpouring from African Americans and their allies, official racial segregation, which had plagued the United States since its inception, faded in the 1960s. Men walked on the moon. The economy boomed. Much of the discontent in the 1960s emerged from a sense of possibility that blacks and whites could live in harmony, that the Vietnam War could end, that there could be a better future for all. Those hopes, for the most part, were dashed by the 1970s. Richard Nixon became president in 1969 and did not end the war. An oil embargo in 1973 led to gas lines. The economy stagnated. The stock market lost almost half its value between 1973 and 1974. Inflation hit 12% a year. Watergate confirmed every cynical expectation about American politics. The nature of protests changed, too. Nixon might not have brought the Vietnam War to a close, but he did end the draft. Freed from the threat of conscription, many thousands of otherwise apolitical young people drifted away from the anti-war movement. The marches against the war became considerably smaller. But as the protests shrank in size, they built in intensity. Frustration, especially at Nixon's re-election in 1972, convinced many that the era of peaceful demonstrations had passed. To a degree that can scarcely be imagined today, the bomb became a common mode of American political expression. In 1972, there were 1,962 actual and attempted bombings in the United States, with 25 people killed. In 1973, 1,955 bombings with 22 killed. In 1974, 2,044 bombings with 24 killed. The movement was small, but those who remained were the violent core. Membership in the Weathermen, the most notorious bombers in the counterculture, shrank from 400 in the late 1960s to just 50 in the early 1970s, but their bombings continued. No region symbolized the rapture of the 1960s or the venom of the 1970s more than the San Francisco Bay Area. The Summer of Love, a carnival of music, drugs, and sex in 1967, established the city as the center of the American counterculture. This largely spontaneous festival drew about 100,000 young people to the Haight-Ashbury neighborhood and brought the word hippie into broad circulation. In a similar vein, the free speech movement at Berkeley also began in the mid-1960s. At the time, speakers on campus were only allowed to advocate on behalf of the Democratic or Republican Party, and an earnest young cadre of students began conducting demonstrations arguing for a greater range of expression. In short order, the movement defined Cal as the epicenter of American student activism. These events became magnets drawing young people to the Bay Area for adventure, for politics, for some fantasy of what the country might become. Yet by the 1970s, both San Francisco and Berkeley were wilting under the weight of so many new arrivals. Politics and music yielded in significant measure to drugs and violence. And then, in an especially sinister confluence of events, a series of unspeakable crimes beset San Francisco almost simultaneously. A serial killer, who portrayed himself as a kind of macabre inversion of a counterculture figure, taunted police for several years in the late 1960s and early 1970s. He killed at least 5 and perhaps as many as 37 people, and then bragged about the killings in a series of letters to Paul Avery, a crime reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle. The letters contained mysterious codes and symbols that gave rise to the killer's nickname, Zodiac. He spoke in a kind of hippie argo with its ersatz Eastern mysticism and poor spelling. But his message could scarcely have been darker. I like killing people because it is so much fun. It is more fun than killing wild game in the forest, because man is the most dangerous animal of all.